Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Happy Independence Day.
Happy Independence Day to you. Happy Surrender of Vicksburg Day, you know, as it is in my household. Actually, it's not really. Nobody cares about that. So this, in honor of Independence Day, or just because it seemed like a good idea at the time, this week we're going to entertain some listener questions. We've got a listener mailbag of things we've gotten via email and via social media, and so we want to tackle some listener questions, and we got a bunch of questions. I'm not sure we'll have time to get to all of them, but we will give it a shot.
And thank you to everybody who sent things, you know, who got in touch.
Yes, and if we don't get your question this week, we'll put it in the hopper for next time we do a listener mailbag episode. So we will see how many we can get to in our usual episode time frame. All right, so I think we're going to start off here with we've got some really challenging ones here. We're going to start off here with a relatively easy one as a warm-up, Frank. Question is about the Electoral College. What is your thoughts on the Electoral College? Does it really have a purpose in modern times? And the questioner sort of mentions that some states are thinking about having a pact to make the popular vote count. Tell me about your, Frank, as a historian of the early Republic, your thoughts on the Electoral College, both in its origins and today.
Well, I can't take credit for this, but some wag on Twitter in the past couple of weeks observed, if we're tearing down monuments to and by slaveholders, let's start with the Electoral College. And I think that kind of sums it up. I don't think, I mean, the listener said, does it really have a purpose in modern times? And I think the answer is no. I mean, and this isn't, I hasten to add, I think it's probably pretty clear to most of our listeners who've stayed with us thus far that we're probably not the biggest fans of President Trump. But I don't actually believe this is, and I realize the Electoral College is responsible for Trump winning the election in 2016. But this isn't a partisan comment on my part. I just don't think the Electoral College, which was created in large part to establish an indirect system for the election of the president, is fit for purpose in a modern democracy with direct voting. So I think it should be a majority vote. So my views are quite simple on the Electoral College and straightforward on that. I know that we have a federal system and that the Electoral College is meant to protect the interests and give a voice to smaller states. But as we've discussed on previous episodes, I think it gives them too much of a voice, frankly, and that is causing problems within the system as well. So my own view is I think the Electoral College should go. What about yourself?
Oh, I'm 100% with you on getting rid of the Electoral College. I mean, it does, you know, some, as you point out, give small states some small voice, but it only gives small states a voice, you know, if they are a purple state in some ways, right? That's right. If you're in a small state that's deep red, you know, your vote doesn't, in some ways, doesn't really matter. If you're in a large state that's, you know, bright blue, your vote in some ways doesn't really matter because the outcome is going to sort of is determined beforehand. You know, there are half the states in the union, we can tell you what the result's going to be now. You know, and so that sort of devalues voting as an activity. You know, and as you point out, it's a system that is built in a moment where they are trying to protect the interests of slaveholders with the 3/5 compromise, and that's sort of embedded in the process. And thinking about the American system on a comparative scale, you know, the structure of the American democracy in the 18th century has inspired lots of other countries to copy or be inspired by the American model, but nobody else is doing an Electoral College today, right? That there's no other country in the world that says, oh, that's a great idea, we should do that. And so I think it's time has come. And I think there's a, you know, it's a system that's never really worked the way people wanted it to. And yeah, the people, they've tweaked it a variety of times, and I think it's there are places where I think the broader system of democracy, in order to work well, needs to be revamped. I think that's one of the big ones.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think you hit on something that's quite important. This is an 18th century artifact, and I know I've said this in the past on the podcast. The United States is a little bit of an outlier in that its constitutional system is very, very old. And in fact, it's older than a lot of its analogous country. Even the country we live in the UK, where they pride themselves on having an ancient constitution, well, it evolves. The electoral system today is not the electoral system as it was here in 1789. Yet in the United States, we have this rather aspects of an 18th century system have persisted, and they've assumed an importance simply because of their age that is, well, frankly, counterproductive, I think.
Right. And one of the other ways in which, we're in a very different place and time than people were in the 18th century is that, the Electoral College represents population with the three-fifths sort of twist to it. But voting was not universal in the 18th century by any stretch of, imagination, right? Not
That's
only
right.
were people of color disenfranchised and women disenfranchised, except for like 5 minutes in New Jersey. But, lots of white people were disenfranchised. And so I think part of it was an effort to sort of restrict the franchise, because if you actually do a popular vote, you can imagine a state saying, right, well, we're going to let everybody vote, and states didn't want to have that happen. I didn't want to have a sort of a race for expanding the franchise. That wasn't part of what the Constitution was trying to do. And now we live in a world where all adults can vote. I mean, the one place where, thinking about what's going on in Florida right now with the re-enfranchisement of people who are convicted felons but who have served their sentence. There are questions about sort of how do you change the electorate and how do you actually expand who gets access to the ballot box. And there's all these debates going on right now about voter disenfranchisement and purging voter rolls and all these kinds of things. And all those are sort of amplify the problems with the Electoral College. Right?
Yep.
States don't have an incentive to maximize the number of voters.
That's right. That's
Right.
right.
Okay. So I think we're both eager to kill the Electoral College. I'm also not a great fan of the Senate at the moment, but that could change depending on who's in the Senate. Okay. So that was pretty easy. Also, for a related question, since it's on the Constitution and its legacy, here's a question we got: have the Anti-Federalists been vindicated? And I guess we could read that question in multiple ways, but Frank, why don't you tell us about the Anti-Federalists first so we can figure out whether they have or have not been vindicated.
Well, the Anti-Federalists were the opponents of the debate over the ratification of the Constitution. The Anti-Federalists were those people who opposed the ratification of the Constitution in 1788 and 1789. A number of them eventually reconciled themselves to the new Constitution once it was enacted. Some didn't. It's difficult to generalize about them. I think trying to read between the lines with this question, although it's a very short question, so it doesn't have multiple lines. What the questioner is getting at is whether the federal system has failed, which is what the chief anti-federalist criticism of the Constitution was. This Constitution is creating a very strong central government which will threaten the liberties of the American people. That's the kind of core anti-federalist critique. One could argue that is true. I mean, the power of the federal government today is far greater than anything that the framers of the Constitution could have imagined, I think. And so on one level, that would seem to vindicate that view. On the other hand, there's an interesting aspect of Trump and Trumpism, which is his desire and the desire of his administration in certain key areas, and we see this in the response to the COVID crisis, to kind of offload things onto the states and to give power away from the federal government, in part because they can't be bothered, I think, in the COVID case, for example, to say, well, this isn't our problem, it's your problem. So there's a kind of, I think we've seen a kind of resurgence of the, not the state, but the states in the American context in recent years, and not just on the right, but also on the left, because, you know, in response to the Trump administration's abrogation of the Paris Climate Accord, for example, we saw after that states like California and New York say they were going to adhere to it. So there's always been a tension, you know, this is the story of your period of American history, yeah. David, between the states and the federal government, and the anti-federalists. And that anti-federal thinking has always been part of American political discourse. Anti-federalists got us the Bill of Rights, for example. So the anti-federalist contribution has always been there. But I think I'm not quite sure what the listener's getting at, but I think I would say it's a mixed message. They've been vindicated in the sense that their concern about the consequence of centralized power seem to have come to pass. What do you think?
Well, I mean, the way in which American history has often been told, the anti-federalists have not really gotten a good rap, right? The way that traditionally that the American history gets taught, especially at sort of the high school level, is, you know, the revolution happened, and then the Constitution happened, and some people opposed the Constitution, but they were wrong, and their concerns were not really fully justified. And I think as historians have looked more at the anti-federalists in recent years, you know, these are people who were participants in the revolution just as much as the people who were, at the Constitutional Convention and drafting, the Constitution itself and supporting its ratification, and had a different vision of what the revolution meant. And they had a fear of government power, a centralized government power, and especially of executive power, if they've been vindicated in the 20th century and in the 21st century, I mean, one of the things that has happened has not only been the rise of federal power, but the rise of power in the hands of the executive, you know, and the kind of quasi-monarchical way in which executive power sometimes gets wielded. And I think if we were to sort of resurrect the anti-federalists, they'd be shocked by a whole lot of things. But I think one of the things they'd point to is sort of the ways in which executive power has grown exponentially in recent decades, and how that's problematic, and about how accountability is supposed to work with that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. But that means, okay, so they diagnosed the problem accurately, and to some extent, they're as political scientists, they've been vindicated. Hmm. But they lost the argument.
Well, yeah, and they lost the argument for all kinds of reasons. Part of it is the name they got stuck with was a bad.
That's right.
They didn't really as you point out, this is a diverse group of people who didn't really agree with each other as in terms of what the alternative would be. Whereas the people who were supporting the Constitution that were much more, organized in their.
But you're right that historiographically they've received their due in the past generation or so. I think about the work of people like Saul Cornell, and the kind of their thinking has been taken seriously in ways that I think they weren't before. I mean, I think they're seen as both. They helped shape the debate over the Constitution and our understanding of the Constitution, and are part of the ideological legacy of the Revolution. That was always true, but I think the kind of sophistication of their thinking, because at one point they were kind of portrayed as backward yokels who, you know, were standing in the way of progress, and I think that's no longer the case.
Yeah, well, I think there's this sort of teleology of how American history has been perceived as a. People push back against that.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So I think there's actually this next question is kind of related in some ways. Has the country ever enjoyed more or less political transparency?
Yeah. Do you want to take this one first?
Well, So just thinking about what transparency means and what transparency is supposed to do. When I think about transparency, I think about transparency in the context of government accountability, right? If we know what government does and we watch them closely, that will hopefully keep government to account. You know, that's in the sort of founding generation, that was one of the principles, I think, that the, you know, the anti-federalists were very keen on. You need to watch government very closely and be very suspicious that government's going to accumulate power, and this whole sort of Republican ethos from the revolution that government by itself is kind of inherently corrupt, and therefore citizens need to be persistent in watching government closely. And so this idea of, well, if a government is transparent, then it will thereby be not corrupt and accountable. And, you know, there have obviously been lots of times when government has not been very transparent. The Constitutional Convention is a sort of case in point, where they made the whole convention secret. And, you know, the participants weren't supposed to tell anybody what happened inside the inside the hall. And, you know, the idea that we can actually make government transparent is a, in some ways, a 20th century idea that's facilitated in part by technology. Things like daily press briefings. You know, we start to have press briefings in the early part of the 20th century in sort of the modern form. Woodrow Wilson is really credited with giving the first press briefing that sort of looks like the modern ones. And Woodrow Wilson, of course, is by training a college professor, so I guess he'd like to lecture people about things and answer questions from journalists. And then you get press offices and secretaries. And then you've got things like, you know, the Freedom of Information Act, which comes out in 1966, various sunshine laws that are made in the aftermath of Watergate, that are supposed to sort of open up government both at the federal level and at the state and local level. And then, you know, more recently we've got sort of our ability as citizens to watch government through things like C-SPAN, right, which when it was introduced in 1979 was in some ways sort of revolutionary in terms of creating government transparency. Trivia question for you. Do you know who the first person to appear on C-SPAN was?
Oh, gosh. So what was the year?
1979.
First, so it would have been in Congress, presumably.
In the House, yes.
I'll say Tip O'Neill, but I don't think it's Tip O'Neill.
Al Gore.
No. Well, he invented the internet, of course.
Exactly, of course. Yeah, exactly. But it's interesting that the House allows C-SPAN in 1979. The Senate doesn't allow them until 1986, right? And the arguments that were made in the Senate about why they would or wouldn't let C-SPAN in, you know, were in part about transparency, but they also said, look, government sometimes functions better when it's not fully transparent, and that we don't want people behaving for the camera. We don't want people... We want legislators to be speaking to the room and not speaking to their constituency particularly, or to, you know, showboat themselves, which is the argument why the Supreme Court is not on C-SPAN, right? That they say, look, we don't want to transform this institution because of the presence of cameras and making it more transparency. They think that would actually be bad for government. And I think the interesting thing about the moment right now we're in terms of transparency, is actually lots of things are very transparent, but they're not accountable.
That's what I was going to say to you, David, because you've been talking about government transparency, but the questioner actually asked about political transparency. So I wonder if there's a slight difference there.
Ah, yes.
Because maybe it gets to this question of accountability. So we know – we don't know all of President Trump's dirt, but we know a lot of it. And – you know, just what we know, just what's public record, should be enough to shock the electorate, but it doesn't seem to be. So there's the question between transparency and what we know, and this is the political aspect of the question rather than the government one, and how we react to that to some extent. And it's not just President Trump. We know more about or we have access, thanks to the internet and thanks to social media and things, to all kinds of things, all kinds of knowledge and information of the nature of which we just, our predecessors wouldn't have known about politicians, you know, in terms of gossip and innuendo and everything else. It doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah. You know, and there was this idea, and this is an idea that was very prevalent in this sort of post-Watergate period, that if government was simply made transparent, that the sort of idea behind these sunshine laws, that if things are done in the open, then that will make them less corrupt, and that doesn't seem to be happening at this particular moment. You know, the ability of the press to hold government accountable, the ability of the voters to hold people accountable for their actions seems profoundly limited at the moment.
Although, I mean, you and I have talked about this, and we'll probably return to this, I suspect, in the coming months. There's a very interesting question to consider about what will happen after the Trump presidency, whether that's next January or 4.5 years from now. And I suspect, regardless of when the Trump presidency ends, there will be some sort of reckoning and readjustment, not unlike what's happened in the 1970s. And maybe transparency and accountability will become the vogue again.
And the other this sort of moment that occurs to me about thinking about transparency at this moment right now is, you know, we do know a tremendous amount about what's going on in government, but our ability to pay attention to all of it simultaneously is limited. And there's a lot that's going on in the executive branch administratively, in terms of changing environmental policy, in terms of changing labor policy, in terms of all these kinds of things that are happening in plain sight, but are not getting the same kind of media attention. They're deeply problematic to me, at least. But it, you know, knowing about it doesn't actually seem to generate the kind of political response that one would expect, because so much else is going on.
Well, yeah, there is just so much going on at the moment. You know, we're overwhelmed by information. Much of it shocking. Not all of it actually relevant, but
exactly.
it's very difficult to distinguish between the bright shiny object and what might be important.
Yeah, to be sure.
And I don't know whether we have special insight. I'm observing this as a citizen, not a historian.
I get distracted by the bright shiny objects just as much as the next person.
Yeah, we all do.
All right, next question. Have we, the American people, ever fully recovered from a period of civil unrest, or have we simply quieted the protesting voices and moved on?
Okay, this is from one of our most loyal listeners, Diami, and we want to say hello to him because he actually came and had a drink with us last year, back when we could do such things. And I think apart from my wife, Mimi, and Simon in London, Diami is probably, I think the three of them are our most loyal listeners. So we're particularly welcome this question. I think it's a really interesting question, and so there are two parts of it. Have we ever fully recovered from civil unrest, or have we simply quieted the protesting voices and moved on? And I think the answer is yes and yes, in the sense that there have been times we have recovered and there have been times when we've simply moved on. And it's very difficult to tell what kind of period we're in. For example, the events in Ferguson Ferguson, Missouri in 2015 were quite similar to what we're seeing now, but also different in important ways. But we, or the majority of the American public and the media, seem to have moved on from Ferguson in a way they haven't moved on from the protests after the killing of George Floyd. I don't think that's exactly what – I mean, I think that's what Diami's talking about, but I think in the broader sweep of American history, in terms of civil unrest, when I was thinking about this question this morning, David, and I want to hand this over to you, I was thinking about Reconstruction, because Reconstruction is possibly the best and most egregious example of both recovering from trauma but also deciding to just move on. I think that human beings have an ability to put trauma behind them, and in part that involves a willful forgetting of just how awful things were, and that's how we have to do that in order to maintain civil society. But on the other hand, that comes at a cost, and it seems to me Reconstruction's the best example of that. So I hand things over to you.
Well, so I think maintaining political momentum is always very challenging. And that maintaining the amount of energy one needs to put in to go out and protest every day, one needs to go out and engage in writing letters to one's elected representatives, all these kinds of things. That requires a lot of energy, and obviously there are kinds of sacrifices that are much more profound than that. Whether that's sending your loved ones into harm's way in combat or what have you. And it's, the weakness tends to come, thinking about sort of the examples you cited, the weakness tends to come with white moderates, honestly, that people who are sympathetic to the cause but who have a fairly limited attention span. Right, so if we think about the fight in Reconstruction, white Northerners who fought for the Union were willing to lay their lives on the line to defeat the Confederacy, to destroy slavery, initially to support black citizenship and voting. But by the early 1870s, they've sort of said, look, we've done our bit. We're going to move on to other things. I think you see the same sort of things in the civil rights movement where, after the King assassination, there seems to be less of an interest by white moderates in pursuing that line of activity. But that, for people who are actually victimized are thereby sort of the driving engines behind these quests for civil liberties, their fight doesn't end by just sort of deciding to put it down, right? African Americans in the South are fighting for making Reconstruction meaningful, throughout the 1870s, throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century, thinking about the sort of long civil rights movement that Jacqueline Hall has written about. And the same thing is true for the civil rights movement, which, you can draw very strong continuities between the civil rights movement in the early 20th century to the mid 20th century, the stuff that happened, in Ferguson and today, and that they're all part of the same story. And I think, as you point out, the news media moved on from Ferguson, but for activists and for African Americans, moving on isn't really an option that's on the table for them. So talk about who the American people are and who, when people have moved on. I think it depends on which people we're talking about.
That's right. I mean, the concept of moving on, or the ability to move on, very much is a product of privilege, isn't it? I mean, you can do it because you're not necessarily being directly impacted by the whatever injustice is being protested.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of reminds me of the bit from Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, where he says basically sort of sympathetic but cowardly white moderates are more of a problem than the Klan is. People who say, I sympathize with your cause, but I'm not really sympathizing with your methods or your sense of urgency. And King says, that's easy for you to say because, you're not, don't have to live in this particular reality.
But to go back to the question, so we seem to be leaning more towards the, we've simply quieted the protesting voices and moved on. But have we? I want to go back to the very first part of the question. Have we ever fully recovered from a period of civil unrest? What do you think of that? One could look at the post-revolutionary period. 60,000 loyalists go into exile, which is a not insignificant number of people. But those who remain behind largely reconcile themselves to the new order. So I'm not talking about those that went into exile.
Sure.
And I'm thinking now particularly of the white loyalists in terms of, you know, they're able to partake of political rights and political participation within the new political order. And that might be an example of success, fully recovering from a period of civil unrest. I don't know. Can you think of any others?
Well, I mean, I think there's this sense in which, you know, and this happened, I guess, during Reconstruction too, where we want to be able to reincorporate people, you know, after periods of unrest into the body politic. If you think about sort of the ways in which white Southerners who supported the Confederacy were allowed for the most part to reclaim their property, excluding their property held in people, and allowed to retain their political rights. Thinking being, well, if we extend an olive branch, that will heal all wounds. And it clearly didn't. It didn't fulfill that. It sort of in some ways left the wounds open in other ways. What does it mean to recover from, you know, it depends on what the nature of the unrest is. When the unrest is fundamentally rooted in questions about human dignity and equality, if the resolution doesn't actually address those questions, or if it doesn't fully address those questions, or only sort of partially address those questions, then you can't really recover from it, right? That the wounds are still there. You know, Malcolm X once sort of talked about African Americans having a knife in their back, and that if the knife is 5 inches deep and white Americans pull the knife out 2 inches and say that's progress, well, the knife is still in their back, right? And progress actually means, and healing requires, you know, the knife actually being removed from the back and for an authentic healing to happen, not simply easing the knife out and, you know, incrementally. And so I think it depends on what it means by healing and recovered. But that's tricky, right? I think a lot of these sort of wounds that happen to our political body, to sort of extend this metaphor, are very deep-seated and don't disappear, you know, when the particular moment of crisis is over.
I think this is an interesting question, because another aspect of it is we may think we're healing and recovering when what we're doing is quieting and moving on.
Yes.
On the other hand, we may actually be recovering and think, you know, it's actually more complicated than that, I suspect. And it's very difficult to know. I mean, we can't know the consequences, social, political, and otherwise, of the current moment we're in, possibly for a decade, maybe even longer. And so when you're in the midst of it, it's difficult to know. We're undoubtedly in the midst of a period of unrest, and how it will play out remains to be seen. But I'm not sure we'll know for a good long while yet.
Right. Okay. Here's probably the trickiest question we got, and I've been stood up most of the last night sort of thinking about my answer. I'm not quite sure I've got a good one. Maybe you do. And the question is about: are there research topics in American history that historians simply wouldn't touch in 2020? Are there things that we feel that we maybe want to research but can't, or some topics that should be researched and aren't?
That's a really good and interesting question, and you had more time to think about it than I did. I don't think so. I mean, there are tactical choices one makes for all kinds of reasons. I mean, they might be professional, they might be personal in terms of what one chooses to work on or not to work on. So, you know, as somebody, you know, if you would you do conventional political history? It's not verboten in any way. You're not going to harm yourself doing it. It's not very highly valued within the academy, but there's a huge amount of popular interest in it. So there's an interesting kind of balance to be struck there, but it's certainly not a topic that would get you in trouble if that's what you mean.
And there's tons of political historians. I mean, if you look at our own, you know, department, we've got several people who are primarily politically historians in their orientation.
That's right, including me, and I haven't suffered for it. So I'm not, you know, but it's not necessarily fashionable within the academy. So within the academy, fashions come and go, but fashions are not the same thing as topics you wouldn't touch because they're, you know, untouchable. I mean, it would be hard to see somebody trying to write. You know, the challenge of writing a nonpartisan history of the Trump administration, I think, would be very, very tricky. and again, I'm thinking 10, 15 years from now. I think that might be one where within the academy that might be unacceptable, and I'm using that term, with quotation marks. What do you think? You've thought about this overnight.
Well, so the, you know, recent history is hard. For all the reasons you mentioned, there's methodological things with sources and access to sources and being emotionally and politically invested in the outcome, which may explain why both of us deal with dead people, is that there's not, you know, that same kind of connection to it. I think there are places. I think as a community, historians are very accepting of pretty much anything that that people want to look into without assuming things about the person doing the research that may have in a previous generation been skeptical, right? So I think people can look in, you know, I've seen people who've looked into bestiality and people said, oh, that's an interesting topic. Keep going with that, right? And you think, well, that's, you know, so I don't think anything's off limits in terms of what academics are willing to let other academics look into. I think there are limits when it comes to teaching, right? And what historians are willing to say in public, especially in public venues. And I think there are framings in terms of especially people who teach in the United States, and I think we're a little bit isolated from this, but in terms of getting a backlash in terms of what they do in the classroom, and the sort of narratives of American history, especially the kinds of ones you present in the big survey classes, they're oddly conservative sometimes in terms of being slow to embrace new approaches, slow to embrace different ways of doing it. And I think if you did a version of U.S. History Day 1877 or something, and you went in and said, actually, you know, I'm going to decenter the state and politics from this entire narrative, and we're going to do American history from some different perspective, and we're going to actually do it from a North American continental perspective that decenters the United States and its antecedents. I'm not actually sure that would be particularly well received.
I'm not sure we will be. I mean, we've tried aspects of this over the years. It's actually hard to do.
It is very hard to do.
I mean, the narrative history of the United States is quite political, and when you're conveying it to undergraduates, so this is kind of political with a small p. I mean, yeah. I know how we teach is political as well, but I mean, and the choices we make, but in terms of how you organize it, it's very difficult to move beyond the state. And the presidency in order to give a coherent story to undergraduates, many of whom haven't encountered this material before. So giving them a complicated version of it, which makes you look clever, and I'm not saying you personally, David, makes us look clever.
Oh, I never look clever.
doesn't necessarily work pedagogically. And it's one of the challenges of somebody who teaches the earlier part of American history in inverted commas. You know, the colonial period, we do tend to take a continental approach now. But then once we get to 1776, we're stuck with the United States and its story. So that's a teaching question. But as you were talking, I thought it's not so much – I mean, I acknowledge the challenges – the teaching challenges you mentioned. I think it's not that there are topics that are off limits. I think there might be interpretations that are off limits.
So what would those be?
Well, you know, it's hard to believe a credible historian would give an Ulrich B. Phillips interpretation of the history of slavery in the, you know, today, you know, this sort of slavery as a positive good. There are people on the, you know, nether regions of the internet who are saying those things, but there aren't credible. And I'm not calling for that. I want to make this quite clear.
Exactly.
But what I mean is
that's understood, right?
Yeah. Right. I mean, so I myself, I'm choosing my words carefully. This is a good example. So I think there, it's not that there are topics. It's how one might present one's research findings. I think that would be limited. You know, so there's been a pretty interesting controversy here in the UK in the past few days over David Starkey, who's a very well-known, you know, TV historian and you know, was widely published in Tudor Stuart, particularly Tudor English history. He's quite old now, or he's 75. I looked up yesterday. Anyway, he was speaking about Black Lives Matter and the removal of statues and things like that, and
which is totally outside of his area of expertise. But
but he's seen as a public intellectual, and you know, he basically made statements that were, you know, sort of talked about how wonderful the British Empire was and how benign it was when it came to slavery, and it was bad, and he's been dragged by kind of professional historians on social media and in print over this, and to my view, rightly so. I'm not suggesting somebody makes that argument, but that would be a difficult argument for an historian concerned about their career to make.
Yeah.
In part because it's not makeable.
No, the evidence doesn't support it.
But interestingly, there will be people who saw Starkey's interview, because Starkey, again, has a massive public following. There will be some people who will agree with that. I mean, certainly the interviewer, and this was on some sort of right-wing website, I think, was nodding along and agreeing. And he, Neil Oliver, the Scottish historian, you know, tweeted some support for him. But he's a popular historian. So I think there are interpretations that one wouldn't make. But the implication of this question, are there things you think that you'd like to say that you don't say? And I don't think that's the case necessarily. I mean, I you know, again, I'm not here to stand up for Ulrich B. Phillips's interpretation of the history of slavery in the United States or David Starkey's interpretation of the British Empire. Those aren't views that I think that I don't believe they on their face are sustainable. But perhaps a critic would say, oh, no, you would say that because you're being politically correct and, you know, you know, you're subject to mind control or whatever.
Hmm.
Can you think of any?
I guess you can think of a dozen of things along those lines, which I think I wouldn't say them because they're wrong. You know.
Right. This is it. I mean.
You know, if you said like.
Holocaust denial is.
Or even things like, you know, the U.S. Indian policy was justified, or, you know, the Confederacy was right in their understanding of the Constitution, or you know, there's dozens of things that were at one point argued by historians that you can't say anymore because they've just been debunked to the point where they're not viable anymore, and they're offensive. But yeah, I can't think of anything that would sort of that I'd want to say that I'm holding back from.
But I think the Academy is actually, it's come under fire recently. I think it's actually a pretty tolerant place in terms of tolerating a diversity of ideas and approaches. And I don't think there are topics that are off limits. I think you're right that we are probably most careful in the classroom. And there's actually a case to be made for being careful, extra careful in the classroom.
Sure.
Because, again, our level of engagement with the topics is not the same as our students, and especially when you're doing survey courses or what have you, you do have to be careful. So it's not self-censorship because you're afraid that you're going to be outed by, students as being too liberal or what have you, or a communist. Or I mean, I know that happens, particularly in the U.S., but it's just you kind of have to play it straight and relatively straightforward, at least at the introductory level, in order to give students the tools they need so that we can engage in more serious debates in later years.
Definitely. I think we've got time for one more question, Frankie. You had one that came to you via email. You want to see if we can, do you want to tackle that one?
Yeah, let me find this. Hang on a second. So this is from, in fact, it came on Twitter to me. It might not have been intended for the podcast, but it's a question that came in last night.
Okay. Well, then the fair game.
And because we're asking for questions, is there legitimate information about Sally Hemings? It seems appropriate to read about her and Jefferson. Now, I don't know what the second sentence means in relation to the first. To some extent, it doesn't matter. I don't know whether the questioner actually meant inappropriate. As far as information about Sally Hemings, the answer is yes. And I commend Annette Gordon-Reed's first book, Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy, to everybody as a case study in the use of evidence by historians. It's it's a short read, but it's an amazing book at looking at how historians treat evidence. But one of the things Gordon-Reed does in that book is review the evidence as of 1997 on Sally Hemings and Sally Hemings' relationship with Thomas Jefferson. And what what Annette found was there's actually quite a bit of extant evidence. It's got to be used carefully, like all evidence, but there's a memoir by Sally Hemings' son, Madison, her youngest child, who gave an interview after the Civil War about his mother and his father, Thomas Jefferson. There were accounts by contemporaries about this relationship. And then, of course, we had the DNA testing that came out, the reports in 1998 that greatly added to our knowledge about Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. So there's a lot of information there, and that's been pieced together very clearly and in a sophisticated way by historians, primarily Annette Gordon-Reed, but not only Annette. Also, I'm thinking of, back in the day, Winthrop Jordan and Fawn Brody and other many, many others who deserve our Cinder Stanton, of course, at Monticello, deserve our respect and admiration. So the answer is yes, there's quite a bit of information on Sally Hemings. As you know, David, it's very, very difficult to write the histories and the lives of enslaved people, especially in the 18th century, and particularly women. But there is information there. So I don't know what the questioner means by legitimate information. And all evidence needs to be used carefully, but there is evidence. Yes.
Well, just to sort of comment on what you just said, I mean, one of the things that – and I just want to endorse Annette's book too, and obviously her subsequent books as well, which would sort of fully flesh out the story. And, her training – even though she's an extraordinary historian, she's also a lawyer by both profession and training. And she uses in that book, she builds a case in a very lawyerly kind of way. And I say lawyerly in a positive sense, not with any negative connotations, that she's making she's sort of laying out the evidence and evaluating it. on its merits. And I was intrigued by one, as you were sort of talking about this, the difference, that the language you were using, Frank, because one of the things I think we as historians, the words we use, we tend to talk about evidence rather than information or facts, which I think is...
Right.
And I think the distinction there is important. You know, all we have of the past is the sort of evidence that the past has given us in terms of documents and archaeology and oral history and things that we can use to support a case that we're making. We tend not to use the word fact very much because that implies that there's things that are uncontrovertible and sort of self-evidently true. And I think that's
it's
not
July
the way historians
4th,
work.
David, it's July 4th. It's all we're, this day's all about self-evident truths.
Well, except except Diam said we should be celebrating on the 2nd, so we're celebrating on the wrong day. But and clearly the guy who said the self-evident truths wasn't always reflecting on what the self-evident truths were and how they applied to both his life and the broader state that he was representing. So, I think just thinking about what the nomenclature is when we talk about evidence, talk about sort of the support that the for the Sally Hemings situation. I think there's a robust evidence, most of it in Jefferson's boned handwriting about her life, and obviously you got to sort of interpret the evidence before you, but all history is about interpreting evidence.
Well, actually, there isn't much in his handwriting about her.
Well, there's the stuff in like where they've got her name listed in the farm book and
right,
you
but
know,
that's there are only a couple of instances.
Instances, yeah.
But there isn't much in his hand.
Okay.
Which is interesting in and of itself.
I wonder if that's you can again read that particular piece of evidence in a variety of ways, depending on what you what makes sense and when you're reading the evidence. Right. I think we're unfortunately we didn't get a chance to get to all of our questions, but maybe we'll save those and tackle some of those on a later episode. You got a last drop, Frank?
I have two, actually.
You
David.
Have two? Okay.
Yes. So one is I want to endorse a podcast, which is a short-run podcast offered by the people who do Pod Save America, which may be familiar to a lot of our listeners. But it's called That's the Ticket, and it is – it's a three-part podcast with done by Alyssa Mastromonaco and Dan Pfeiffer, in which they look at the history of vice presidential vetting and how vice presidents select their how presidential candidates select their running mates. And it's excellent. It's really, really good. The only two parts of it have been released thus far. The third part will be out next Friday. And they're doing it to explain how the process that Joe Biden's probably going through at the moment in selecting his running mate. They're not trying to predict who that running mate is going to be. They're just looking at how it's done. Both Dan Pfeiffer and Alyssa Mastromonaco have been involved in selecting vice presidential candidates, going back as far as Al Gore. So they've got some real insight and some very funny stories.
Second time
it.
Al Gore has come up on this podcast.
Yes,
that was not expected. Okay.
Including an instance of excessive flatulence on the part of one candidate. It's a very, very good and very, very insightful. And one factoid I heard this morning while I was cleaning the flat and listening to the podcast was Geraldine Ferraro, who many people will know was Walter Mondale's running mate in 1984. When she was a prosecutor in Queens, she created the unit, or she was instrumental in the creation of the unit within the New York City Police that became the Special Victims Unit, as viewers of Law and Order Special Victims Unit will be familiar with. So Geraldine Ferraro was played a crucial role in that. So that's an interesting factoid. My second so I strongly recommend that brief podcast series. My second if you could have two last drops. My second one is very interesting developments in the convergence of history, pop culture, sports, and politics over the past 2 days, which is both the NFL team based in Washington, D.C., and the baseball team based in Cleveland, Ohio, have announced that they are undertaking serious discussions about their names and their mascots, both of which will be familiar to many people for their connection to Native Americans. And so both the Cleveland baseball team and the Washington football team, after years of pressure, are responding to this particular moment. And it's particularly notable because the owner, Dan Snyder, of the football team in Washington has been very, very reluctant and resistant and indeed rejected all suggestions that that team should change their names. And some people have been already suggesting different name changes. One thing I saw on Twitter, which I really liked for the Washington football team, would be to name them the Red Scares.
Oh, geez.
I don't think that's going to go anywhere, but I think that would be quite clever.
I saw Red Tails after the World War II fighter pilots.
But anyway, I think that's it. We're apropos of Diami's question about whether we're just going to paper things over and move on, or whether there's real change. This may seem superficial to some people, but these, I think, if both of those institutions change their names, that would be quite significant.
I would concur. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, David, what's your last draw?
Well, I just want to bid a fond farewell to our friends at Backstory, which just released their last episode, and their last episode is about last episodes and about farewells. So they talk about like television shows going away and politicians retiring and other kinds of things. But they've been, I think, as everyone who's listened has probably knows, been doing that show for a dozen years.
Wow,
a variety
that's not
of. Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it started off as a radio program, and then it, you know, became a podcast, and you know, they've you know, had some hiatuses in there, so it's you know, but they've done an amazing amount of great content, and obviously it's all available online. So even if the show is ending, there's still a great catalog of things to listen to. So I just want to say congratulations to everybody involved in Backstory and you know, people of the Virginia Humanities and whatnot who will put all that together. So cheers to them and congratulations on the last episode.
Do you have a favorite last episode most important last episode of a TV program, David?
Oh, geez. I tend to dwell on the ones that are bad rather than the ones that are good. I guess if I had to pick two favorites, they would be The End of the Americans.
I haven't seen it yet. I mean, I'm watching The Americans, but I haven't got to the end.
Okay.
Well, The End of the Americans is Trump gets elected president, right? And it's a great Soviet victory. I'm not sure
tragic.
I like that ending.
No, that's – listeners, that's not how that series ends. There was a show, I think it was called Newhart.
Oh, God, right.
Do you remember this with Bob Newhart where
– I don't remember the end, but that was a great program.
Well, okay, spoiler alert for a show that was 35 years ago. He wakes up and the entire show was a dream being had by Bob Newhart's character in the Bob Newhart show.
Very
and
postmodern.
He wakes up next to the person who played his wife in the Bob Newhart show, saying, "I had this very strange dream." And so, you know, as an ending for a show goes, I mean, ending a TV show is hard, especially sort of a sitcom, and most of them do it badly. But
well, MASH was good. I mean, the two that come to mind for me, I think MASH did it well, and I'm still pissed off about the ending of The Sopranos. Because I thought The Sopranos was great, but I hated the ending. And it's too cool for school. I mean, or too clever by half. So
To be sure.
But
you know, we'll not mention, you know, Game of Thrones or other kinds of things, which disappointed lots of people. Right. Well, this is not our last episode. So we'll be back next week. So cheers, Frank. Talk to you then.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.